Greetings, listeners, and welcome to another episode of Compare and Campaign. I am your host, Tom Lando, and with me, as always, is my co-host,
Miguel.
And we are not only co-hosts, but we are co-DMs, co-GMs. We run role-playing games, is the gist of it, but not on the show. On the show, we talk about the role-playing games we've run in the past, and we tell our tales, and we glean little insights and comparisons and contrasts between them, and hopefully give you some advice that you yourself can take to the table when you're running a role-playing game, or you can just get inspired and come up with some cool campaign ideas, because I certainly get a lot of that when I'm doing these episodes.
Yeah, man.
It is the 20th of November, 2021, and this is going to be episode 87, I believe. I have a big one this episode, and I was just saying before this episode to Miguel, I got to start working on my posture because my shoulder's been tingling, my back's been acting weird, and immediately I'm sitting here like goddamn not Letterman. Who's the other guy? The guy who kind of sits like with his hand on his knee and leans forward.
With his hand Larry on his King. Knee. Larry King. Lando King.
Why do you do that? Yeah, this guy's practically being the model for my bad posture here because I'm like leaning forward into the mic with a hand on one knee. This is bad. It's bad for my back. But if I stand up straight, you're not going to get the good audio quality. I'm not going to be close enough to the mic. So that's a bummer.
Podcasting. Bad for your back.
I mean, it would be good if I had a different mic setup, but I mean, who's got time for that? Not me. Miguel, what do you got for us today?
I'm going to be talking a bit about session 3 of the Verse, where the heroes get a job, and we'll see. It sounds like Al's Aces are about to embark on a really big adventure, so we might only get past the point where the heroes in the Verse get the job before we have to wrap things up. But this is going to be the first sort of like, you know, the first gig that they get.
And whenever Miguel talks, that's when I'm going to be straightening my back out to correct my posture. So
it's going to be... listen for the popping, cracking noise.
Hopefully we're going to balance that out. All right. So who do we want to start with?
Well, we better start with you. Well, because you got so much to cover, and I have a pretty obvious point about halfway through this adventure where it would be a good place to break. So so we'll see sort of where we're at once you cover your session, and then and we'll see how far I can go in mine with our own little time limit.
And I mean, I'm going to be doing doing a similar thing where I'm like basically... like, I'm just going to be talking and watching the clock and seeing, like, when I basically have to stop. Because I think I've got, like, at least a couple episodes worth of stuff here.
I'm very so we'll curious, see. And maybe even before we get into it, I can ask you this question, which is, was all of this adventure that you're about to describe, was it all done in like one long session with your players, or was this broken up over a few sessions?
This was definitely broken up. I'd say it was broken up maybe into like in design into like four parts.
And oh, right then I on. Think okay.
In practice, maybe a bit longer than that.
It's a really big one, but it's hard to tell, you know, sometimes you run one of those like day long games with your players where you're just playing all day long. You can get through a lot of material on those.
And I mean, I'll tell you this, like, I think I just said that it's sort of divided into four parts, and like the second part of that I've looked at, and like I don't think that would be much of an episode. Like it's, that will be pretty quick, but I may even fit that in this one, but we'll see. Shall I jump into it?
Or do yeah, you, have you any take more it, man.
Preludes or questions? Do you remember when where we left off last time? I had a bit of a tease for where we were headed, but it's been a little while. A lot's been going on.
Yeah, I'm afraid I do not remember, simply because the past week has been quite busy for me.
It's been a whopper. So I'll just go ahead. Oh man, I've also had a thing this week that like I specifically, because I had so much to say this episode, I said we should like have most of our side chat before the episode and just leave it at the episode. But there is something relevant to this show that I definitely got to mention, because I've been so into it the past week, is the release of a new game called Silver Bayonet. You know, I'd been reading them sharp books, them pulpy Napoleonic historic war books, and then freaking Remembrance Day, November 11th this year, all of a sudden it turns out there's this new skirmish game from the creator of Stargrave coming out called Silver Bayonet that's about supernatural horror in the Napoleonic era. You got little units of dudes with muskets and pistols and bayonets and sabers and whatnot. And, man, you go, you fight some werewolves and stuff, and you look for clues, and, you skirmish with another team from an opposing military while you're at it, or maybe you team up with another team to take on the forces of the supernatural. It's great. Can you
remind our listeners what that series of books is?
The Sharp novels?
No. It wasn't the Sharp novels, was it?
Oh, Osprey.
Osprey.
Osprey Publishing.
That's the one.
Is it Osprey Publishing? Yeah, Osprey Publishing, who, they're one of the people putting out Silver Bayonet. And I think that they also put out Stargrave as well. So, but they've also got bespoke miniatures for the game being put out by North Star Figures, I think it is. Or maybe it's North Star Hobbies. North Star something. North Star Silver Bayonet. You can find them. Lots of people on the internet getting excited about it, making little dioramas and stuff. And I've been just jumping into it in Tabletop Simulator. I've been having a lot of fun with it. Anyways, that's all a different thing, because that's been distracting me this week, let me tell you. But jumping back to last episode. So we had just finished tying up the second of two loose ends that Al's Aces were assigned to deal with, basically before they enter the Draelic War for the Deathlands. There's going to be a massive Draelic invasion of the Deathlands to try and liberate it from the Nightside Eclipse. This has been Al-Samasath's sort of plan that he's come to, is that he's just going to try and drive back the Nightside Eclipse within Drael to the best of his abilities, even though launching a military assault of this nature, or like a, you know, starting a war like this, is kind of counter to MPOC policy because of the inevitable fallout that comes from waging war with the undead, basically, as you tend to just bolster the forces of the enemy as you're doing it. But Al-Samasath doesn't have the guidance of Odium, the founder. He's just doing what he thinks is best in the position. And so he has begun the Draelic War for the Deathlands. And that just started last episode, but the Al's Aces, they were not engaged in the war itself yet. They were busy carrying out just a couple missions beforehand and at the start of the war, so that certain distractions and considerations would be handled before this major conflict breaks out. So one would think that the next big thing would be they go start carrying out operations in the field. They start, you know, helping out on the battlefield, taking out key targets, that sort of thing. That's definitely in their future one way or another with this Draelic War, but the expectation is that that's where they're headed next. But instead, first of all, they're enjoying a breakfast, a rabbit stew, and ale with Dax, Chessie's boyfriend, the goblin armorer, who has been hard at work securing the arms, armor, and munitions required to supply the Draelic army in their invasion of the Deathlands. Then suddenly, I mean, they're with Dax, they're basically at the armory. They're right there in the old Empok base. And so they're eating breakfast with him, and then suddenly a red alert forces the party to scramble to the portal room so that they can rapidly deploy to the Crimson Tower, which is under attack. With the bulk of their allied forces far south in the Deathlands, Al's aces must assist the beleaguered defenders of the Crimson Tower far to the north of the Deathlands against an extraplanar assault force sent by the Nightside Eclipse. And, you know, pretty much the first thing that comes to anybody's minds is Dangus, it's those Crimson Chambers. It's that Dangus Crimson Queen in her Crimson Chamber. The Nightside Eclipse found out about it. Maybe it was Serpentine spilled the beans when she went rogue. Something. These Dangus Nightside Eclipse have showed up to bust out their Crimson prisoners.
Aw, Dangus.
It's a whole lot of Dangus, let me tell you. So, and
but
you
it's
know,
but it's not that. It's not that. Because as we all know, the Crimson Tower doesn't even exist.
I mean, this one certainly does, and it's got some VIPs, but the P stands for prisoners, because, and even worse, all these forces have been sent south to the Deathlands, so everybody's, like, literally on the whole other side of the continent, and it's basically just the people who are still stationed around the Crimson Tower and the Empok that can rapidly deploy through these portals that is responding to this Nightside Eclipse assault force that seems to just be, like, coming out of, you know, some other plane, just showing up in force and just launching assault on the Crimson Tower.
Maybe if they didn't keep everything in one tower, this wouldn't happen.
Well, and it's funny you say that, because actually, if we go back, like, the fact is, they had already been so paranoid about these prisoners that they had ejected their first captive, Lokash, so that he was just destroyed in the sun. So really, I think in actuality, they only have the one prisoner here in the tower. They've got enough Crimson cells to house more than one, but I think at current, the only captive they have in the tower is Nadia, the Crimson Queen, but she is, like, you know, she's sort of like an ancient foe that's been imprisoned for who knows how long. They don't want to know what happens when she gets out. So, first, they get there, and there's immediate damage around the tower that they have to deal with. They have to go around putting out fires, clearing debris, saving civilians that have been, like, caught in the initial, like, surprise attack. And then early on in that, they encounter a team of Nightside Eclipse raiders led by one of the Autumn Leaves. These are these skull-faced helmet guys, these elite
specialized assassins, Eclipse, right?
Yeah, they're like elite Nightside Eclipse agents that are meant to be like anti-Empok agents. And they wear this armor that's, like, basically all stylized to look like bone. And so immediately it's like they run into this raiding party led by an Autumn Leaf. And that's already sort of starting to point to, like, okay, this extraplanar attack, it's probably an Autumn Leaf led assault or something like that. They dispatch that team of raiders, and then they fight their way through a small group of Azers and Smoke Mephits to a shrine to Apollo nearby, where a small pack of Ghasts, which are demonic ghouls, and zombies is lurking around. They've been just sort of set loose by the Nightside Eclipse. But one of the ghouls is freaking on fire. So there's a flaming ghoul raging about, and they got to deal with these undead.
Aren't ghouls vulnerable to fire?
I don't think so. But I should point out, this is actually, I didn't mention, this is Operation Coriolis. And the source for this operation that I'm drawing a lot of this stuff from is the second Dungeons & Dragons epic for the Adventurers League, which I've mentioned before is when they do, it's like a sort of finale event that they do towards the end of each Adventurers League expedition season. They'll do an epic that is designed to be run at a convention, and it's supposed to be like an adventure that multiple parties at multiple tables are taking part in one huge event. And in this case, it was the simultaneous attacks on Molemaster from all four of the cults of elemental evil at the top of the big, or at the end of the big elemental evil season track. Basically, the city that the season's been set in becomes under attack from like the fire cult, the earth cult, the water cult, the air cult, and each party, basically, depending what their level range was, got to participate in the battle against one of those cults, like from one of those angles of attack. And so I took that and just made it the assault on the Crimson Tower, the surprise attack where the Nightside Eclipse and the Autumn Leaves attempt to liberate Nadia, the Crimson Queen, from the Crimson Tower, this ancient vampire queen. And basically each phase of the battle, though I did each phase, instead of having it all be different, four different cults, it's just four different angles of attack launched by the Nightside Eclipse through this huge extraplanar assault.
Oh, nice. It's a good way to handle it. Have you, just as an aside, have you ever, like, attended a convention, played one of these modules that are meant to be run by multiple groups?
No, but I've got breaking news.
What?
I just figured I can lower my chair a good deal, and it fixes my mic problem.
Ah, well.
I don't have to be slouching forward.
Ah, good.
Thank God. Because my shoulder was really starting to buzz. Oh, boy. But no, I've never been to... I don't know if I've even... I've played... I've been to conventions where they were playing games of Dungeons & Dragons, you know, like, I think I've mentioned it, before, but it seems like such it seems so far in the rear view, Can Games, I think it was. Can Games? Have I mentioned this before?
Yeah, you've mentioned that. It was a while back now, many episodes ago.
Yeah, so, and the thing is, because of the pandemic, it's like, I don't know when the last Can Games was, but we had a big, you know, role-playing, wargaming, all that stuff, board games, all that convention in Ottawa that I used to attend. But it's funny because I have more memories of seeing people playing at other tables, like playing Dungeons & Dragons. I feel like I never really played a role-playing game at one of those that I can remember. I've definitely, you know, early on when I first started going, it would have been because of like a Warhammer tournament or something like that. And I think that there's like a guy who's like still has his old Mage Knight Dungeons collection who runs Mage Knight Dungeons there like annually. And they have like some really interesting games like that, that are like just like fan favorites that are like run by a guy who just comes back every year and runs the same game. But yeah, I think most of my experiences there were playing war games. And so I've seen people at tables at these things, you know, role playing their characters and stuff. But I don't know if I ever actually took part in one.
I can safely say that I have never once played a role playing game in any context besides with my friends in like a casual setting. Like, I've never even played an RPG at, like, a game store or something, you know, like, Thursday night D&D. Never done it. It's always just been with my groups of friends. But
yeah,
I have played board games at conventions, and I have even attended large Magic the Gathering tournaments. So there's that.
Yeah, and it's funny because, like, so I think I mentioned this before on a previous episode, but back when, like, I first got Big Eyes Small Mouth, the first role-playing game I ever got, I ran a game of it at my local hobby store. Like, there was a sort of thing where, like, I think it was over the March break or something, they had a system where there was, like, a schedule set up, and you could just, like, schedule games of Warhammer throughout that break. And me and some of the guys in that group, we took one of the slots in that schedule and scheduled, instead of a Warhammer game, just this role-playing game we were going to play together, but like with little miniatures and stuff, and like we decorated the board and stuff, because we had like come from war games, and so that was like what we were very used to. So that, I think, is my only experience of playing a game other than a war game in a hobby store. And then beyond that, I think the only other thing is that I was part of, like I played some games in, like, the Carleton University role-playing group or whatever. Like, I ran a game of Scion. I just like dropped into a game of Dungeons and Dragons when I was like first checking it out. And then that is also how I got to play the game Paranoia, which is the only time I played that.
Think.
Yeah. So, once the immediate concerns outside the Crimson Tower are dealt with, they've dealt with the raiders, just sort of like the immediate damage, the undead that have been released around this shrine to Apollo. Alzaces take to the sky with their new jetpacks to deal with the primary threat looming on the horizon, a massive rolling fortress similar to a Jawa sandcrawler, but with a giant horned skull mounted at the head of it, and, like, skulls and bones engraved all down its metal plating. It's a big freaking, I think it was called, like, the Bone Crusher Rolling Fortress or something like that.
Nice.
So the players are able to get the drop on some of the crew that are patrolling the huge war machine's outer walkways. And not only that, but when they land on those walkways and sort of, like, throw the crew off the walkways and dispatch them, some from the ground nearby, they get blessed by some thankful patrons of Apollo for saving the shrine, before they descend into the vehicle's interior. So the crew inside is like a mix of Dwerger and Gnolls. And there's also a whole bunch of like Mephits, like smoke Mephits hanging around the machinery that are like further frustrating the combat. But while Ara Stormblast Kendor and Nestle Goodberry are engaging the crew inside, Chessie Dildira drinks a potion of etherealness that she's been hanging on to for a while. And using the benefit of etherealness, she's able to, like, a ghost, like, she literally becomes the ghost in the machine. She, like, passes into the engine's inner workings and, like, comes out of etherealness, like, with it, like, ducking among the gears. And then she's able to sabotage the Rolling Fortress from the inside by using her rapier and booming blade, which I've talked about before, is this ability where you stab something and, like, if it moves, it takes thunder damage. But she reasons that, like, all the machinery is in constant motion in all these, like, pistons and stuff. So she, like, just stabs them all with the rapier and does booming blade. Then the thunder damage is, like, guaranteed to activate, and it creates this chain reaction that just, like, destroys the engine from the inside.
Neat. Good move.
So she sabotages the machine's internal power source from within and disables the Rolling Fortress before it can reach the Crimson Tower. And then she slips back out to rejoin the other aces on the bridge of the machine to take out the gnolls that are and the Dwerger that are running the damn thing. So then, once they've dealt with this big old war machine, they gotta fall back to the Crimson Tower itself because they're still fighting off enemy ground forces with the help of a handful of local defenders, like maybe 7 or 8, like, guards and, you know, whatnot, just like basic soldiers. Al's aces manages to battle a group of Nightside Eclipse infiltrators who are assaulting the tower. But these infiltrators are like a weird sort of strike team of the Knights sent by the Nightside Eclipse. It's not the usual, it's not an Autumn Leaf, it's not your usual cultists. First of all, they're led by a gremlin who has this unfamiliar explosive device, but also he's accompanied by a retinue of burn punchers. And this is a unique enemy that is from the module, from the fire cult. These are Dwerger fire cultists who, quote, plunge one of their hands into a vat of molten iron halfway up to the elbow. Once cooled, the iron is then engraved with symbols of fire that glow with a menacing reddish light. And so they're called burn punchers. They punch you, and it burns you. They have a burning punch.
I like the flavor of that. Silly name,
though.
Yeah,
it's pretty great. So they fight these infiltrators who, like, there's regularly reinforcements coming in, flaming undead, swarms of mephits, steam mephits, smoke mephits, all the fiery ones. Eventually, the party is able to secure the explosive from the gremlin, take out these bad guys. And after examining the device with the help of some of their superiors who have also, like, rushed via portal to the tower, they determined that this explosive is a reality bomb. So the way this works is it's a weapon of mass destruction capable of drawing energy from an elemental plane such that the material of the plane on which it's detonated is, like, overwritten with the material of the elemental plane. So, for example, if you detonate a reality bomb tuned to the elemental plane of fire on a mountain in the material plane, the mountain just turns to pure fire and it just, like, incinerates everything. It's, you just be like, have a mountain of fire collapsing on the land. So basically they're using these bombs that are just going to, like, completely destroy really a huge chunk of the Draelic Highlands, not just the Crimson Tower. And, these, I should say, are based on the elemental node sort of, like, there are similar elemental node weapons of mass destruction. I've talked about the elemental nodes before. They're like these elemental, like almost like shards of a plane, of another elemental plane that the cult of elemental evil is obsessed with. But they can also be used as these, like, powerful super weapons, and I basically just redesigned them to be weapons of mass destruction for the Nightside Eclipse to be wielding against the Empok and Drail. But there is a solution to dealing with these bombs, which is they can be safely detonated if they are banished, which sends them to their plane of attunement so that they can be swallowed up by the force, the same force with which they explode. So you banish one of these bombs that's attuned to the plane of fire, and it just goes to a world of pure fire where it, you know, who cares if there's more fire? Whatever. So once they deal with that bomb, they banish that one. A series of quakes leads the party to deduce that the Nightside Eclipse is launching another attack from underground. And Nessalie has a unique insight into this due to her recent connection to the Godseed fragment, which has given her some sort of like weird earth-based attunement. And so with this knowledge, the party is able to track down the tunnels that the Nightside Eclipse are using to get under them, and they descend into those tunnels to root the Nightside Eclipse out. So down in the tunnels, the first thing they encounter is they encounter a pack of bat cobs and a Nightside Eclipse monk who, once they defeat this monk, they actually discover on him, they have to do a bit of a check to identify it, I think. But it is, right, it's like a planar map, which, again, it's just sort of like going back to the idea that this is like an extraplanar assault. Specifically, this is like a planar map. It's a map of basically like the Autumn Leaves. I think I may have mentioned before, they come from a secret base that is like attached to Citra Arha, the Nightside Eclipse like home base. And that secret base is called the Carven Spire. It's like a huge, it's basically like a huge sort of shard of the negative energy plane, like of the void, that has been cut out and displaced and sort of attached to the, and I'm getting kind of confused with my own sort of lore here, because I'm trying to remember how exactly it works. But basically, like,
I think that's really funny, actually, because, you know, sometimes you quiz me on like, hey, do you remember this? Do you remember that? And man, you even get confused by your own lore.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't quiz you on like, what is the secret nature of the base of the Autumn Leaves? Like, how does it relate to the negative energy plane? Like, I think I would ask you things generally that my characters, like my players, would know. I don't think they'd know the exact intricacies of this, but the point is that
you say that, but as we revealed in the episode where you had them do that quiz, they couldn't even remember the name of the guy they had saved in the previous session.
Well, that's the real kicker. But basically the Autumn Leaves have a base that is sort of like branching off of Citra Arha, that is sort of like a connection between Citra Arha and the negative energy plane. It's like this multi-level complex that's almost like composed out of the void. And this map that they find on this Nightside Eclipse monk in the tunnel is a map of the Carven Spire. And so suddenly they have this key piece of intelligence that basically tells them both where this attack is coming from, but also it's like they suddenly have a map of the Autumn Leaves secret base. And yeah, because it says planar map, I'm sure that like what the planar map is also really telling them, beyond just giving them a map of the Carven Spire, is like how they can get, like they already know from their adventures earlier how to get to Citra Arha. Now using this, they'll be able to use that, like the knowledge from this map, to like recalibrate their portals to send them to, the Carven Spire, this secret Autumn Leaves base. Once they've got that, they proceed into the tunnels, and there's a place where, like, the earth is caved in, and some civilians have fallen into the tunnels, and they're being attacked by carrion crawlers. So briefly, the party has to save some civilians, take out some carrion crawlers, then proceed further into the subterranean tunnels of the Nightside Eclipse, where they run into more monks who are armed with acid throwers, like flamethrowers, but like spraying acid at their enemies. They've also got four cockatrices, which, you know, just a little evil, like little reptile chickens, but it's a real bane of the owl's aces. They hate anything that can petrify you, let me tell you. So they gotta take out them cockatrices. Then, finally, they continue, basically, like, these tunnels lead them into the Underdark. They realize that this, like, this tunnel goes way deep to, like, way beneath the earth, so that whatever reality bomb they're gonna be triggering triggers, like, far beneath the Crimson Tower to have, like, a really calamitous effect on the surface, so that everything just sort of, like, falls into the Underdark. And down here is where they start to fight more monks, assisted by Mud Mephits and Bullets. They've also got these weird sort of, like, mud human, they're not quite golems, but they're, I called them mud simulacra. They're just sort of like a strange, like, mud drone people.
As soon as anyone brings up mud men, all I can think of is the movie Spookies, which features, like, one of every monster in a haunted house. And my favorite, of course, is in the wine cellar, mud men, like, grow up out of the ground and for some reason are extremely flatulent.
I'm going to quote Red Letter Media. Don't hurt that spooky. I like
yeah,
that spooky.
Yeah, don't hurt that spooky. Spooky's
a little
great,
fish
by the
spooky.
Way.
Little Fish Spooky is the good one. Yeah, a movie about a kid who finds an abandoned house with a party in it and assumes that it's for him. So they have descended in the Underdark. They've been fighting these Nightside Eclipse monks, Mud Mephits, Bullets, basically like subterranean creatures now. Like they're starting to go into the tunnels and fight. Again, this is like the earth elemental cult part of it, so you can sort of see how that's coming out. But it's this idea of like this is the Nightside Eclipse force that is attacking from underground. And eventually they finally come to like the staging area where the Nightside Eclipse has embedded this like crazy drill-looking bomb that is gonna, like, burrow into the earth and then activate. And here they face another one of these gremlins alongside two bodyguards. But also, down here, there's tons of, like, crazy quake effects that are being triggered by the instability of the reality bomb, like, gearing up down here. There's poisonous gas leaking through the area, so they have to have their rebreathers on and be checking against that. Although another thing I notice here in the notes is that one of the monks that they took on earlier when they were fighting the monks with the bullets actually had a scroll of banishment. So conveniently, I'm making sure that they don't run out of banishment so that they can banish these explosives so that they don't detonate calamitously. And also, on their way down into these tunnels, they found in the like sort of underdark hideout of the Nightside Eclipse down here, they had taken a number of prisoners. And there's another thing where if they rescued the prisoners, similar to how if they saved the Shrine of Apollo, they get blessed when they're attacking the Rolling Fortress earlier. Down here, when they're fighting the gremlin, they have a bonus to their AC as the prisoners come to act as bodyguards for them as they fight this gremlin and his two bodyguards. And eventually, they defeat the Nightside Eclipse down here and are able to get rid of this this subterranean bomb situation. But then they got to head back up to the surface because it's been a, they get a sending that informs them that now the Nightside Eclipse are attacking from the sky. And they got to get to the surface. They got to get to some new flying machines that the Dwarven Professor Nesne and Robling has created for the MPOC and have been landed nearby. And I think that's where we'll pick things up next episode.
I love it. I love that there is, like, you know, ground assault, air assault. This is, I suppose that's what you were talking about, having different teams of players handling sort of different aspects of it, right?
Yeah, so depending what level your party was, you'd be assigned to a table that was on one of the four tracks for this module, and each track is of a certain difficulty level and corresponds to one of the four elemental cults. And so one team would be fighting the rolling fortress that the fire cult has brought. One team would be going down below the city to they'd be fighting first in the sewers and then going into these subterranean chambers that existed below them. One team goes up into the air to fight enemy airships. Then another team goes to the docks and has to launch to sea to hold back a naval invasion. And also, the official results of these battles were tallied. And I think there was, I think half of the cults managed to accomplish their objective. So now in the lore of Dungeons & Dragons, it's like Mullmaster is this devastated city that has seen, huge flooding and maybe something else. I'm not sure. But, it wasn't completely destroyed, but the situation is pretty bad these days because some of the cults managed to break through in that big event.
And so your plan for this was just to take the players through each of those different tracks, one at a time?
Yeah.
Nice. That's fun. That's cool.
Yeah, and it's actually, now that I think of it, it's literally what I'm doing with the third season module like this, with the campaign that I'm literally running right now, week to week. In fact, we're just about to finish, so,
cool.
Happens all over again.
I think that's a good way, an elegant way to handle it, and it gives your players, a little taste of everything.
Yeah, I mean, it certainly gets the most out of the module for me, and of course, the players are basically, they're really in the late levels now. They might be level 17 going on 18 now or something. So, I mean, at this point, I think the actual module was designed for groups that spanned from, levels 1 to 10. But, I mean, at the level they're at, they could easily take on all of the parts of the module as written. And in reality, I think I, upped the challenge for each module, so that would be more appropriate.
And the players get to enjoy everything. Doesn't matter what table they're sitting at.
And of course, the whole time they're getting little magic rings, magic potions, scrolls. They're picking up a little gold everywhere. There's all the basic Dungeons and Dragons things that they're getting. It's a full Dungeons and Dragons experience. It's just with this sudden note of urgency where the entire Draelic military is somewhere else, and suddenly there's the Nightside Eclipse are attacking from four different angles with weapons of mass destruction on a location where they've got a mysterious unknown VIP held captive, and they don't want to know what's going to find, they're not looking to risk letting Nadia out and seeing what happens. So it's a big day. It's a big battle.
Cool. I like it. And you said this took four sessions to do, right?
At least.
Well, now that I know that there are four different tracks, I guess that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. And I mean, I just covered two in this episode, I would say. and definitely a couple more after. I may be able to get the next two into the next episode like this one, but we'll see. I know that there's like a whole thing of like they have to jump from airship to airship in this sort of fleet in the air, and then after that they've got to go from the beaches and attack an enemy ship. So we'll see. Could take a while.
So it's on to the verse then?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So at this point in the story, the crew of the Phoenix, they start off by fixing a ship, putting the crew together, getting the ship in working order, and taken off from Cleaver, the home planet of many of them. And then their plan is to find a job. And the captain, Danilstack, he knows a guy who probably has a job for them. A guy on a planet not too far from where they were, planet called Ezra. And so they set off heading for Ezra. But along the way, the travel wasn't too smooth.
But now they got a little something in their ship now, and it ain't the centipedes.
That's right. Along the way, they had stopped for repairs at like a pleasure space station, a leisure based space station, and they played some games, solved some disputes. And while they were on the space station called Cloud-9, the Alliance showed up and they were looking for a fugitive. And the fugitive was actually going to be meeting with a group of Tongs who were on Cloud-9, unbeknownst to the players. And also unbeknownst to the players, while they were on Cloud-9, the fugitive stowed away in their escape shuttle. And so we pick things up, and they are almost at planet Ezra. But, I should also note, they found out who the recipient of Minerva's package, the crate that she inherited from the late Captain Ben Hastings. They found out who is to receive that package, and it just so happens that it is a space station, a Skyplex, that orbits around Ezra. And so when we pick things up here, they are just arriving near Ezra in the Georgia star system. The sun is called Georgia. And as they approach planet Ezra, they can see this silver sort of insect-like shape of a Skyplex orbiting the planet. This tall, spindly-looking station with repair shuttles flying around it, and then, more elegant personal transport shuttles docked vertically with the tower in the center near the top. And just to throw in a bit of flavor for my players, I wanted to give them the sense that, you know, I always like to try and make it feel like the universes that my players are playing in are these living things. And since we're playing in the Firefly universe, I decided to have to hint at the idea that the events of this campaign are happening concurrently with the events of the TV show Firefly. So they, as they approach the Skyplex, they notice that a Firefly class vessel is docked on one side of the docking ring. And so Caesar takes them in and hails the Skyplex. And
so are you trying to like, Are you trying to like line it up so that like there are specific episodes going on, or is it just generally like Firefly is happening?
Once in a while, I will line it up so that there are specific episodes going on. The thing with Firefly, the TV show, is that while it is, you know, in chronological order, there are big gaps of time in between the episodes sometimes. So like, you know, The span of time between two episodes might be a matter of months. Oftentimes an episode will start and the crew of Firefly are just finishing a job. So you get the sense that like that whole season takes place maybe over the course of a year, you know, 13 episodes over the course of a year. And so I do have these little touchstone moments, and this is one of them, where if the players were so inclined, they could watch the show and go like, oh, okay, so that happened right before we showed up or something like that. But I didn't do it like with every single episode, just a few key moments. And so what I'm doing here is the players are on their way to meet a crime boss. Man,
that makes me wonder like if there's a show or a movie that I would like enough that I'd want to do that.
Well, it's also very easy with Firefly because it only has the one season. So there are like 13 episodes. And you'll see what I mean about
I could probably do it with one of the Star Treks.
Yeah, Star Trek maybe. But Star Trek is pretty big, though. Of course, you could do like, you could set a campaign in the DS9 universe and then have the Dominion War going on in the background kind of a thing if you wanted.
Yeah, that's like exactly what I was thinking of, basically. I was thinking, like, you know, one thing that I always go to is I try to think about, like, you know, because there's Star Trek and there's Star Wars and whatnot. And it's like, you know, what really deep down is like my favorite sci-fi setting of like the big ones that are in the popular consciousness. And I often come back to is I just love aliens, man. Except then, with Predator and Aliens, they keep coming back to it and freaking ruining it, or like trying to. It's like, I like Aliens, but I don't give a fuck about all this. I don't like this idea that androids made the alien. Like, the perfect organism was an idea that they had that then they made.
It's
and then
different
they
with a TV series versus a series of movies.
Yeah, I guess like.
Man, yeah, those Prometheus, Alien Covenant, like, oh man, can't do it.
But would I, like, you know, but then if it was done really well, like The Mandalorian, would I really like an Aliens show, you know?
Well, I mean, that's I feel like we're going to get into just pitching an Aliens show. Like, I'd watch a show episodic, kind of like The Mandalorian, where each episode is just the freaking space marines going on different missions in space. And they don't even have to be fighting aliens every time. It could be, you know.
No way.
No?
I bet, you know what I bet would happen is they do like, what I bet they would happen is it'd be just like Mandalorian, where the first season, it'd all be pure, just like I like it. But then the second season, they'd start introducing some mystery that corresponds to Prometheus or Covenant or something. I'd be like, ah, you dangest. Just like they did with The Mandalorian.
That's exactly how I feel about The Mandalorian, too. All of that to say, though, like, here's what I'm talking about. Here's an example of this. The person who is the recipient of this package is a crime boss from Firefly named Adelai Niska. And he is a recurring character throughout the series. This crime boss who, you know, at different points, like, he hires them for a job, or they stab him in the back, or he captures the crew of Serenity. But I was like, okay, you know, let's have a touchstone here. Where are you going to go to get a job? Well, go to a crime boss. There's a crime boss already in the lore. So let's make it that Adelai Niska is the guy who is the recipient.
You know what I'd probably do this with? Is I'd probably do it with like a video game. Like, I'd probably do like a Borderlands game. You could fill it with all the classic characters.
Yeah.
You could do like a Disco Elysium game where all the places and events are like relevant to it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I think it's because like specifically role-playing games like video games, they're specifically asking you to put yourself in that world.
Right.
Perhaps more so than like a show or movie is, like where a show or movie is about these guys' story. You know, unless you're playing these guys, you know, like this is the thing. You mentioned the idea of like a Banshee show before, and it's like, well, if it's not about Job and Lucas and that, it's like, is it really a Banshee show? You know?
So here's the thing, right? Like, you're sort of feeding into what I'm getting at, where if you're setting a campaign in an established world from like a TV show, you know, so much of what makes a TV show are the characters. You're following this group of characters week to week, and you watch them go through their struggles, and you watch them grow and change over the course of the series. And I wanted to make sure the remind the players, who are all big fans of Firefly, that, like, yeah, this is the same universe. The events of the show are happening, like, somewhere off in space, concurrently with the events of this campaign. And I never did it sort of, like, one-to-one. But an example here is the players are going to go meet Niska. Niska is a character on the show, and... early in the show, there's, like, this whole thing where the crew of Serenity go and meet Niska and they get a job from him. So all I have happen here is the Phoenix pulls up to Niska's Skyplex. They see the Firefly ship docked there. And Captain Stack is like, okay, you know, Caesar and Song, you guys stay on the ship, keep it warm, and, like, be ready to get us out of here if the deal goes wrong. Minerva and Gale, you come with me. Minerva, you know, you do the talking. And so they dock at Niska's Skyplex. They walk down this gray corridor, and as they're walking down the corridor, the crew of Serenity just pass them heading in the opposite direction, just having come out of the meeting that takes place in, like, you know, episode 2 of the series. That's the kind of thing. And, you know, they overhear, like, some banter between the crew. But I didn't want it to be like, okay, you're going to team up with the crew from Firefly. It's more just like, yeah, the crew from Firefly are in this universe too. They're off doing their own thing. And if a player was feeling like really, really sort of zealous, they could watch the show Firefly and go like, oh, cool. After that scene, that's when we walked in. So that's the kind of, those are the kind of moments that I included. But it was never like... I rarely do this. I only do it a few times just as, like, a fun little reminder, a little Easter egg, if you will.
I think that, like, my inherent, like, impulse with these sort of, like, fictional settings is, like, I'm so... It's not even, like, that it is going to happen, but I have such an interior, like, anxiety of, like, what if I do step on, like, something that is all reestablished within the thing? It's like, I always lean towards, like, my version is, like, the next generation, right? If I was going to set it in an established setting. Like,
right. Well, again, like, this one really benefits from the fact that Firefly only has the one season. It only has the one movie. And, like, it was, like, long since over at the time when we started running this. So I wasn't dealing with something like Star Trek, right?
Like, and it's a big setting too. Like, it's all of space. Whereas, like, one thing that came to my mind is like, ooh, I'd like to do a prisoner RPG, but then I'm like, yeah, but I wouldn't want the prisoner from the show to be in the prison when I did it. Like,
you don't necessarily have to have the prisoner, but you could definitely have, what's his name, number 2, right?
Yeah, because he's always changing, and that's exactly what I would especially play on.
Exactly. And you could even throw in an offhanded reference like, oh, your predecessor didn't know what to do with this situation.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Definitely do that. Those are the kinds
the prisoner 2049.
Yeah. But those are the kinds of things that I'd throw in occasionally just to... And they always played really well. My players are always like, oh, snap, like, there goes Mal. Just passing on by. Anyway, they go to meet Niska. And I have this... Like, I even wrote it like a screenplay. And the idea behind this, the exchange that they have is... I'm using the D20 Modern diplomacy rules, which are very similar to the D&D 3.5 diplomacy rules, where you have, you know, hostile, unfriendly, indifferent, friendly, and helpful rankings. And based on how good your diplomacy rolls are, you can sort of raise or lower the attitude of the person you're trying to finesse in order to, you know, turn things in your favor. So what happens first is, like, they come in, Niska is unfriendly to them, and he's like, so what can I do for you? they show him the crate, and he, like, turns it around, punches in the code, and, like, looks inside, and then quickly shuts it so that the players can't see what's in it. And he goes, like, you know, how did you come to have this? Did you open it? I assume you'd like compensation for returning my property. We did some negotiations with Minerva trying to change Niska's attitude. And basically all this did was determine the reward that he was willing to give them. And they got him up to friendly, so he gave them 500 credits for returning his package. The negotiations conclude, and Niska is sort of, you know, he leans back in his chair and he's looking at the crew and he goes, you know, since you're so kind to bring me my package, I have another job for you. But, you know, first we got to talk about reputation. Reputation is everything here. You guys have no reputation. I've never even heard of your ship, and this concerns me. I don't like to do business with people I don't know about. No reputation means you're either new or you're bad at the job. And I'm going to give you the benefit of the doubt and say you're new. And they're like, yeah, we're new. And he goes, okay, sure. So I have a, you know, I like a guy with confidence. That's a quick way to earn a bit of reputation. And I have a reputation that you have probably heard of. Mine isn't from gossip. And then he shows them, he sort of like pulls open a sliding door and there's a guy chained up in there who's obviously being tortured. And he goes, 2 weeks ago, I hired this young man to bring me a ship. Being young, he's really foolish. Goes very fast, crashes into an asteroid belt. And now the ship is broken and the young man leaves it there. And then he looks at the guy and he goes, oh, not this guy, though. This guy is my wife's nephew. He closes the sliding panel and then he opens another one. And then there's a guy in there who's dead. He goes, it was this guy. This is the guy that failed me. And Niska explains that there is a transport class ship that, you know, it hit an asteroid belt and the crew abandoned it. They left in the shuttles. And now it's just like floating out in space, waiting for scavengers to steal it. But it's Niska's property. So he wants to pay the crew of the Phoenix to go and get it. He's going to give them 300 credits, and he's going to even throw in a magnetic towing cable that they can add to their ship. And, you know, come on, bring it back to me, is basically what he says. They do a bit more negotiating, and then it's finally decided, okay, we have a deal. See you back here in a week with my ship. Thank you. And so they leave, and Seth, who is playing Gale, decided that 300 credits is like a pittance, and he starts a big argument with Minerva saying, like, you know, next time you gotta finesse him more so that we get a bounty that's actually worth it. Or, you know what? I'll do the talking next time, and I'll make sure he knows we mean business. And this establishes almost like a, like, button heads between Gale and Minerva that becomes sort of like an ongoing subplot, as the two of them not getting along, and then, of course, eventually getting on the same page.
Now, and Minerva, were the players who played these characters, were they the couple, one of the couples?
No. Minerva is Caitlin, and Seth is Gale. The couple are Caesar and Song, who are on the ship.
Right. Sorry. So,
cool. Yeah, but I mean, Seth is a really good role player. He's always willing to just sort of put aside the dice to really lean into character moments like this. And Caitlin always likes it as well. So the two of them really made it this sort of fun ongoing subplot, having their characters butting heads and then getting along and sort of developing a begrudging respect for one another. But this kicks off the idea that, you know, Minerva is just having a shitty day. She has an argument with Gale. She gets back to her bunk and her dog has just trashed the bunk, torn up all the sheets from her bed, and she's just, like, you know, in a miserable state, and now they gotta go way back out in space and do a job for this person that she really doesn't trust. Caesar and Song, meanwhile, are on the bridge, and they're sort of surprised when a couple of astronauts sort of pop up in front of their windscreen and start installing this Magna Grapple launcher onto their ship, and Dan'll explains that that's what's going on. I even have in my notes this funny thing where the Magna Grapple is like plug and play. So on one of the screens on the helm, a little pop-up comes up and goes, do you want to install the Cinemoy System's Magna Grapple version 4? Yes, no. And then Caesar presses yes, and there's like a quick loading bar that fills up and then makes a ping noise, and then just a button appears on one of the flat screens that now launches the Magna Grapple. And so they head out, you know, let's get rambling. They go full burn out to the asteroid belt. It takes maybe a day, so I gave them a bit of downtime just to sort of do their own thing. And they get there, and the asteroid belt is just this massive wall of hovering rocks sort of bouncing around, rocks ranging in size between that of like a basketball and the size of a space freighter. So just like, you know, rocks of all shapes. And the closer they get to the asteroid belt, the taller and taller this wall of rocks. And so they arrive, and the ship's proximity sensors are going nuts as they approach. And they've got a
lunar lander.
Yeah, they've got to go in there and find this ship. And so I ran this one as kind of like a skill challenge, but skill challenge is usually like you do sort of multiples of the same skill, I find. I mean, skill challenges were always sort of a flawed system anyway, I think. But the way I did this is four checks, different skills. You got to do a pilot check and then an initiative check, and then navigate, and then another pilot check. And so the ship swoops low under a large asteroid, and then Caesar can see that a series of asteroids are like knocking into each other like billiard balls, you know, transferring the energy one into the other, and they're coming right into their path. So evasive maneuvers, just got to get the ship out of the way so that it doesn't get smushed. As the ship makes its way through the asteroid, Caesar catches a glimpse of the abandoned starship, you know, out sort of in the midst of all the asteroids, and then a big rock wheels through her field of vision. And so she guns the thrusters, makes her way over to it, and the ship looks totally dead. And they go in, they try to see if the ship is still online and will initiate an automatic docking procedure, but it doesn't. So instead, they go for the manual docking procedure. And as they're pulling in to dock with the ship, an asteroid clunks off the windscreen of the Phoenix and leaves like a small crack. And Danil goes like, so maybe once we're on the ship, you should pull back and, you know, keep it a safe distance. We don't want to damage our ship alongside this hunk of junk. And we'll radio for you to come back in, power up the towing cable. We just don't want to stay any longer than necessary. And for this session, as I indicated before, like I split up the group so that there's always somebody on the ship.
I gotta ask before we get off this, what was the initiative check for?
The initiative check was to get out of the way of the asteroids knocking into
each
other.
Billion balls?
Yeah.
I knew it.
Yeah.
It was like an attack that they had to have the initiative to move out of the way for.
Precisely that. And each of those checks has like a success and a failure condition. Like the initial pilot check, if she succeeded, she'd get +2 to the initiative check that follows it up. But failure is she gets hit by an asteroid and deals some damage to the Phoenix. And ultimately, if they fail the navigate check, which is the one to find the abandoned ship, if they fail it, then I run parts of that challenge again as they sort of pilot around trying to find it. So the longer it takes to find the ship, the harder it gets to stay in the asteroid field. And so, yeah, I wanted to always have someone on the ship, and it's usually Caesar because Caesar's the pilot, but I never wanted Cecily to get bored just sitting there on the ship, and I'm pretty sure you can see where all this is going. So Song, Gale, Minerva, and Danil suit up and go to check out the ghost ship. And they go inside. Once they're inside, Caesar pulls away to a safe distance just outside of the asteroid field, but maintaining radio contacts. And once inside the ship, the crew discovers that, like, it's just totally dead in there. No signs of life. The air is really cold, but the air itself is still breathable, so they can, you know, lift up the visors on their helmets and breathe normally. And Minerva also, Danil asks Minerva to bring Allegro, her dog, along to sniff out to see if there are any, like, nooks and crannies like the one that they found on the Phoenix. And so they start spreading out to check out this ship, this Caravelle-class freighter. And Caesar disengages. And as soon as Caesar is outside, just like on the edge of the asteroid belt, well, then console, the forward console beeps, a yellow light begins to flicker. Well, that's really odd. The shuttle airlocks are sealed, the engines fire up, and the shuttle takes off into the asteroid field. And Danil comes on over the comms and goes, like, is that an alarm I hear? The lifeboat's gone? Well, get after it. It's our goddamn escape shuttle. And so as the bulk of the crew are searching this abandoned ship, there's a space chase going on between Caesar and Chao Hu, the stowaway who has now stolen their shuttle.
Little do they know, Haunch has been taken hostage by Hao Chu.
Oh.
You never even asked what Haunch was doing this whole time. He's got a freaking gun to his head. He's in the shadows. He doesn't even know. Oh, jeez, guys.
Get after him. Haunch is on the shuttle. Da-da-da.
Sure hope they catch up with that shuttle because I just... I may have just written a check that Haunch can't cash.
Don't worry, they do. This was okay. This was a really fun one to run.
I also want to ask, the dog ripping up the bed, was that something to do with Hao Chu?
No, it wasn't. That was
cool foreshadowing.
It was just like pathetic fallacy. Minerva's having a crappy day. And also, I wanted to give, like, I've talked before about familiars, like players having familiars, and how too often the player is just sort of like, oh yeah, my familiar is here. You know, I have a familiar who's a raven. He's just on my shoulder at all times. But nobody really pays attention to the familiar until you need it. That always bugs me, because animals are characters, you know? And so I wanted to make sure that Allegro sort of had his own character. Like, he's still a dog, so...
But this is, like, a good opportunity to be, like, the thing that the dog... Like, because they're not paying attention to the dog does something that could have alerted them to something that they're not catching on to.
It's true. A missed opportunity, though. I had it that Allegro had been... just shut in Minerva's bunk, so he was restless.
I don't know, you could just retcon it so that, like, Hao Chu was stuck in the wall behind, and that's why he was so mad. That's why he was freaking out like that.
Sure. We'll go with that one.
I don't understand. Normally he's okay in the room.
Oh, that's weird. That's probably nothing. Who can understand the inner workings of the canine mind? So this was a really fun one to run because I was running simultaneously a chase scene and like a location-based exploration scene. And it was always exciting to sort of cut away from the chase and go to sort of like a more tense, like sneaking around a ghost ship kind of scenario. Playing with different types of tension. Caesar just heads off following after the shuttle, and the rest of the crew are exploring the abandoned ship. And they don't find a lot. They find like a bunch of food that is frozen solid, protein bars, freeze-dried miso soup, soil grown peaches that are frozen like solid, like hard like baseballs now. They find, I did a lot of sort of fake out moments too, where I'd sort of build tension. You know, they go into the locker bay and they're looking around and they open a door and suddenly they find themselves face to face with the barrel of a 9mm pistol. But it turns out it's like a crew member who has been frozen and he was hiding in a locker. And so he's frozen, but still pointing the gun outwards. Lots of little moments like that. Or at a different point, they sort of split into pairs where Gale and Minerva go to check the lower level of the ship and Song and Daniel check the upper level. And, you know, again, this was an opportunity for Minerva and Gale to role play their kind of disdain for each other. But Song and Daniel, they're looking around the upper level and Daniel says, like, you know, why would anybody leave this ship? Looks like it's in fine condition. Hey, Song, are you a superstition man? A superstitious man? I'm not, but my ma sure was. She used to tell me ghost stories about empty ships out in the darkness. She'd say they weren't really ships. They were just flying coffins. Vessels filled with tortured souls of spacers who died out in the inky nothingness. Wait, you hear that? You know, he draws his pistol. He goes, wait here. He walks through the double doors, past the kitchen area, and out of sight. And then I just have... You know, he goes quiet, and then Song goes to follow him after a moment, and Daniel jumps out and scares him and fakes him out, and he goes, I'm just kidding, there ain't nobody home. Let's see if we can get the engine on. And they go up to the bridge.
Daniel!
Yeah. They go up to the bridge, and they're looking around, and they notice from up top that there's another ship coming to intercept the one they're on. So here's a fun situation, right, where suddenly our crew is without their own ship, and that also means that this other ship doesn't know there's anyone on the abandoned transport freighter. And
you know, it's funny, my big frame of, like, my big point of reference when you were doing the Verdant Apocalypse was Black Summer, and now you've finally seen it and you know why.
Yeah.
But I feel like this one, the point of reference that I may be developing is actually the current season of the Adventure Zone, Ethersea.
Because
it's a lot of this sort of thing where it's like, you know, they have to go retrieve something from a shipwreck or like from a something that sank in the initial cataclysmic storm. And so they have to go get it. And so they have these vapor suits that they wear that are like magical sort of wetsuits that they put on that protect them from the pressure and everything when they get out of their ship. They swim over, but it's always that sort of situation. It's like one player's on the bridge of the ship sort of monitoring things and something goes wrong for them. Then the other two are in the wreck and then another ship shows up or something and it's like, uh-oh, and oh man, it's great.
I mean, this goes back to the sort of storytelling rules I was telling you about, the ones that I set for myself when I was putting this together. Like, anytime there's a bad situation, make it worse. So, bad situation? Well, they're in an asteroid belt. Make it worse. Well, there's a stowaway who's trying to steal their shuttle. Make it worse. Okay, they gotta split up, and most of the crew are now alone on a ship that won't even start. Make it worse. And another ship shows up. So it's just like this constant kind of escalation where each story beat ups the stakes.
And the ship is haunted. And it's full of zombies.
Man, I mean, I didn't quite go that far.
Like that heavy metal, that part of heavy metal.
That'd be pretty rocking, actually, to do, I'm thinking about, there's that Grant Morrison comic series, Nameless. Did you ever read that one?
I don't think so.
It was like a 6-issue series, and it was basically Grant Morrison does Event Horizon. It'd be pretty fun to do something like that. Some nice
Grant Morrison.
Hmm.
Just the other day, I had a Facebook memory pop up that was just Heart Grant Morrison.
Heart Grant Morrison. Back running the chase, It's just like a lot of pilot skill checks and, you know, running similar sort of skill challenges to the one that I did to get into the asteroid belt. And this one I did have sort of a map laid out, and I almost ran it. I didn't know at the time, but Bane of the Tradeways has that chase scene where the distance isn't really a factor. It's more the idea that you've got these two vehicles and you can like match speed, go ahead or fall behind. I sort of ran it in a similar idea, but I did have a distance did matter to a degree because I had these obstacles. I had the asteroids that they had to move around. But eventually, the whole idea is Caesar is having a hard time catching up to the shuttle while navigating around these asteroids. But at a certain point, she remembers like, oh wait, we just got a magna grapple. And so with a well-placed ranged attack, she magna grappled the shuttle and reels it back into the Phoenix, initiates an automatic docking procedure.
I was about to do a bunch of sound effects, but I didn't remember this Firefly, so everything's silent.
Everything's quiet in space. And yeah, so she initiates...
In space, no one can hear you in space.
Oh yeah, that goes back to your idea. A whole campaign set in the Allen universe. So she initiates an automatic return sequence, which she can enable for the shuttle, right? You want to be able to call back your lifeboat when you're in range. And so she gets the shuttle to remotely dock, locks it into place, and then goes and has a confrontation with Chow. The two of them have like a little scuffle, but Cecily had put a lot of points into dexterity, and so...
And like, luckily, Haunch had smuggled that scalpel away from Song all that time ago. So he had a concealed weapon. So when the pistol gets off him, suddenly...
He turns the tables on Chow. Anyway, they manage to wrestle Chow into the brig of the Phoenix and lock him in there. And at the same time, the players on the Caravel ship noticed this other ship coming in, and so they hide. They hide on the ship. This other ship docks, and the cargo hold door opens up, and it's another crew of like bounty hunters like themselves come in. And so there's, and I fan cast this one pretty well. There are three of them, and my fan casting for these are Bai Ling is the leader, and then Adam.
So, like from Warrior?
Yeah.
So you're fan casting this after the you're retroactively.
Oh no! You misunderstand. The actress Bai Ling.
Oh, sorry. I said from Warrior. She's not in Warrior.
No.
It's Mai Ling in Warrior.
Right.
No, Bai Ling. Yeah, no, I remember Bai Ling. Yeah. She's she played Serpentine in Southland Tales.
That she did. I would have referenced, I was going to reference The Crow. She's in The Crow. I watched that recently.
I think she's in Crank 2.
Yeah, she is in Crank 2. So Bai Ling is the leader of this crew. Adam Beach is another one of them. And it was easier to do these fan casting things so I could just sort of pull up images of these characters because they don't know who they are yet, right? So I would describe to my players what they were wearing and then like throw up a picture and they're like, oh, okay. And the one that got a big reaction is the third member of this boarding crew is Danny Trejo. And I remember my players all going like, fucking Machete is getting on board? Well, we're in trouble. And so they all spread out and hide around this ship as this other boarding party enters. And I think that's where I'll leave it off now, where they're suddenly being confronted by another team of like bounty hunters like themselves.
Well, damn, that's a hell of an episode. I'm glad Haunch doesn't have to be around the scary actors. He'd be awful scared.
It's a good thing that Haunch made it.
Things went from looking real bad for Haunch to looking better for Haunch than they did for the other guys. So
it's true.
Yeah. This is something.
And I will say too that this other ship that has arrived, it's called the Cantankerous, and the crew of the Cantankerous are like constant thorns in the side of the crew of the Phoenix. They become sort of ongoing rivals, competing for the same jobs, often turning up, like trying to pull off the same heists, that sort of thing.
So now I have to inform you of something that was established in Ethersea recently because I brought it up.
Okay.
Is when the crew of the Ethersea, so first of all, the crew in Ethersea got their ship. They had to name it. They decided they would name it the Coriolis. Funny coincidence, the operation that the Empok did in this episode was called Operation Coriolis. That's complete coincidence that I happen to be talking about Ethersea, where they use that as the name of the ship in the episode where I'm talking about this. They're years apart. It's uncanny. But
the McElroys are like reverse ripping us off.
So, Matt, yeah, anyway.
They're ripping us off before we know, before we even say the thing.
I referenced Red Lair Media earlier. Did you see the Red Lair Media, the thing about Lower Decks ripping off Red Lair Media?
Oh, I didn't watch it, but I saw the video come up in my YouTube recommendations.
It's uncanny.
Mm.
So they named their ship the Coriolis, and then Griffin, at the end of one of the episodes, when they go to get a new job from their, like, agent, basically, or their quest giver, they run into, like, this other team that's, like, a team of bullies, basically, that's going to be their rivals. And nice. They go to them, and they say, if it isn't the crew of the Glory Holis. And they were all like, damn, that's really good. Okay, you tell us your ship's name now so we can come up with a cool burn for that one. And they're like, our ship's got a name that you can't make fun of. And they're like, well, what is it? And they're like, they just change the subject. And then at the end of the episode, they take off from the port and the players can see them. And Griffin says, and just on the back, just as it pulls away, you see the name written across the side, and it's the Gut Punch, which rhymes with gut with butt munch.
nice.
This is a perfect finale. You see that their ship is called the Gut Punch, which rhymes with butt munch, and then the theme starts playing.
Nice. I like it. Yeah, it sounds like there are a lot of similarities between Ethersea and the Verse.
Yeah, it's pretty kick ass. It's funny because for a long time I had wanted them to do a sci-fi adventure zone, and this is like, it's like they decided they would do a sort of compromise, like not quite sci-fi, but it still very much feels like a sci-fi series.
Hmm.
So I think that has been basically a solid episode for us. I mean, it's basically been an hour and a half. We haven't gotten a tavern picks, but let me tell you, one of these days I am going to bring Silver Bayonet. I still owe the listener some stuff about Powers of the Vampire Clan Gangrel. But
that's right.
Also, you know, we did that fun exercise where we talked about Stargrave and I had you come up with what your team would be. I have bought Silver Bayonet now and have all the rules now. And so we can actually make your Silver Bayonet unit in our episode, and that'd be sick. So I'm looking forward to that some episode.
From what I hear, not to delay our wrap up, but Silver Bayonet.
Oh, not at all.
Whenever you talk about it, it keeps reminding me of this video game that was not well received, but I always like the premise, which is The Order 1886. Do you know this game?
It's funny because when you said video game, I was like, oh yeah, The Order 1886. But what's funny is that the thing that keeps getting mentioned in relation to this game that seems like very pulled out of forgotten lore is the film Brotherhood of the Wolf. Do you know that one?
Oh, man, you know what that is? Like, I don't have guilty pleasure films, but if I did, that would be a guilty pleasure film for me.
It's basically like a silver bayonet. Because I kind of love it,
but it's also got like Mark Dacascos playing a Native American, which is really awkward.
It's bad. It's basically like when you said guilty pleasure, I'm like, it's basically a movie about a silver bayonet unit that just beats the shit out of a gang of peasants, like ad nauseum through the movie. Like, it's just dudes in tricorn hats, kung fu kicking like impoverished civilians.
I kind of love it though. Man, like, the action is genuinely good, and I love the look of these high-collared guys in tri-corner hats, like, fighting with a staff,
it's very Silver Bayonet.
Pretty stupid.
it's very Silver Bayonet. The other thing, like, speaking of guilty pleasures, is Dog Soldiers. I mean, Dog Soldiers, but with muskets, is basically like, hell yeah, Silver Bayonet. I love it.
I'm into it. Can't wait to hear more.
So, this episode has been episode 87. For me, it was Operation Coriolis. It was session 3 of the verse. It's been the 20th of November, 2021. If you want to get in touch with us, you can check us out on Facebook. Follow us on Facebook. See when we post new episodes. Message us if there's anything you'd like to say to us. You know, for the first time, I used my Twitter for the podcast in a long time, which is at NarNog. I used it to shout out, Emmanuel, the creator of, Fleshscape, and, tell them about the episodes where we talked about their game.
Hell yeah.
So that's at NarNog if you want to see that, but, like, I barely use it, and it's mostly just mine. And then beyond that, you can check out our show notes. You'll definitely see some videos of Brotherhood of the Wolf and the Spookies. Order 1886 and whatnot. Yeah,
don't
Spookies.
Hurt that
spooky. Yeah, my God, it'll do that whole Red Letter Media. We could just do that one clip that someone made that's just them saying, like, don't hurt that spooky. Oh, I like that spooky. anyways, all that and more on our show notes page, which is our blog, our WordPress page, compareandcampaign.wordpress.com. Check us out there. And, you know, if for some reason you're able to steal anything off that blog page, don't, because it's probably haunted.
Yeah, don't steal anything off of that abandoned spaceship. It's probably haunted.
Oh, my God, that's true. But if anything is haunted, you know, person who cursed it, not me.
Level up, get your ding.
Ba ba da ba, ba ba da ba, ba ba da ba. Gotta fix my posture.